And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm delighted to welcome Inman Majors back to the program today. Inman is a novelist originally from Knoxville, Tennessee, who is now a professor at James Madison University in Virginia. His novels are Swimming in the Sky, Wonder Dog, The Millionaires, Love's Winning Plays, and the recently released Penelope Lemon, Game On, which is available from Yellow Shoe Fiction, a series from LSU Press. We recorded the interview in his brother's backyard in Nashville, Tennessee, so don't be too alarmed when you hear sounds both natural and man-made in the background. Now, when the book opens up, Penelope Lemon is at her 9-year-old son, Little League practice, and she's got a lot of different things running through her mind.
Yeah, she's just been divorced for the second time a few months prior, and she's sort of assessing her life and how her marriage came to an end. So as she's watching her son be the worst player on his Little League baseball team, she's thinking about her husband and a very short robe he used to wear in the mornings, and she's wondering if that is actually the cause of their divorce.
So please describe this little short robe to us.
Well, you know, the idea for that came when I was in grad school. I had a friend who's the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a Youper, and so he lived with a buddy of mine, another Tennessean, and so I'd come over there some mornings, and this guy would come out in a short silk robe. I mean, it barely came out mid-thigh. He was scantily clad, and I think I was scarred by that robe. And so we couldn't believe that someone would go out in public in that. So he'd be outside watering his plants and stuff. So anyway, the idea for that robe, I think, came from my grad school days. It's very short. It's silk. It looks like a kimono. And Penelope does not find it alluring when her husband is hoping to, perhaps to get a little frisky.
Well, there's a difference between not finding it alluring and then just it being a totem of distraction and dissatisfaction.
I think that, I can't put it better than that. It's a totem of dissatisfaction, for sure.
There seems to be a lot of things she didn't like about James's demeanor. Why do you think they got married in the first place?
Well, you know, I think we're catching her. I think anytime I've never been divorced, but, you know, I've been in relationships and friendships that end. And when they end, especially early on, you're focusing on what went wrong and why things didn't click or why things didn't last. I think, you know, he's a smart guy. I think he's funny in his own way. I think he's handsome. So the reason they got divorced, I think, is he started acting dissatisfied with her, you know, and so he would do things, you know, sort of passive-aggressively to finally, where she finally said, okay, obviously I'm not making you happy, so perhaps we should split up. But it was really his idea to get divorced, but he sort of put the onus on her with some passive-aggressive stuff. So she's focused on things, I hope, in a comedic fashion, the way we focus on, well, the things that drive us crazy when we know we're no longer going to be with that person.
Once heard an older couple talk about how they had stayed married for something like 60 years or so, and they said, well, we never fell out of love at the same time.
Ah, right, right. Well, I don't want to analyze it too strongly. Or don't let my wife hear this. We've been married 21 years come September. I teach at JMU, and, you know, one of the things I tell my friends that you don't realize is you need to be marrying someone you like a lot. Romantically, it's great. That's important, too. But if you're going to spend 40 or 50 years with somebody, you need to like a lot about them. You need to have things in common with them. You need to sort of agree on religion, child rearing. You know, do you value more money and more things, or do you value more time? So I think a lot of marriages go wrong on those sorts of things. And that's the kind of stuff that it's hard to figure out when you're young. So, you know, Penelope, James, that's what we're talking about now, is her second husband, and he's kind of the polar opposite of her first. So I think that happens a lot, too, that you know, whoever you are with, you can sort of marry the opposite, or you end up with the opposite of your last relationship. So I didn't get married until I was 32. I used to always joke that, you know, I'd like to marry my third spouse first. And so that's, hopefully Penelope will, number three will be the charm for Penelope, I hope, one of these days.
James seem to have these conflicting desires to come across as folksy, but also as intellectual.
Yeah, so what's your question?
Well, it just seems like he was a guy that had conflicts within himself. And
yeah, I think there's, you know, I'm sort of having some fun with the idea of Frederick Turner's idea of the West being no more. So he has this idea that he wants to be a frontiersman, and he has these ideas about masculinity. And he's sort of struggling with some of the things I think modern American men struggle with, is like, you know, how do I feel adventurous in the old time way when I'm, you know, an accountant or a professor or whatever it is? And so I'm sort of having some fun with the anxiety of the modern American male, and you know, I think he wants to. He sees himself as a Renaissance man. He reads a lot. He's sort of self-important about how smart he is. You know, I pick on James a fair amount. He's not a bad guy. You know, he's a little pompous, a little full of himself, but he's a good dad. He's not mean. I'm just kind of having some fun with, you know, some general anxieties I see out there in society.
And he's definitely penny-wise and pound-foolish.
He's cheap, yeah. You know, yeah, he's cheap. He times Penelope's showers. at the same time, he'll go out and buy an archery bow for $1,200 they never use. So finances are kind of an ongoing issue there for the couple as well.
To say that Theo isn't the next Mike Trout or Bryce Harper is an understatement.
I coach baseball. I coach my son's Little League baseball team from like 4 to 12 probably in Waynesboro, Virginia. I'd say 70% of the kids came from single mom families. I wasn't that young. I was, you know, in my 40s. I had my kids late and I was married, and it was still challenging to have two kids and get them to their practices and all that kind of stuff. And I was just amazed about these young women, their mid-20s maybe. They're sharp. But maybe they didn't go to college. Maybe they didn't finish college. Maybe they got married or, you know, had to quit for one reason or another. But they were sharp and they were cool. And I had a lot of respect for how they could keep all these balls in the air. You know, you might get a call one day, you know, Jimmy's not going to be at practice today. I blew a head gasket on my car. But, they, you know, they didn't feel put upon by life. You know, they might be working at the Little Debbie factory or at Lowe's, making an honest living. And so my original intent was to write a serious book, sort of honoring those sorts of women. And then I had an illness. I'm fine now, but I had an illness. And when I got better, I was like, you know, I want to write something funny. So about the challenges that single women face. And a lot of the stories that come through in the novel are stuff that's happened to friends of ours, relatives of ours, you know, some of the dating issues and the challenges of dating in the social media area. My original idea came from that. And so, you know, when you coach, you realize that there's kids out there that maybe aren't athletic, but they're cool, you know. So I really got I was a decent athlete. You know, my son's a very good athlete. But I had tons of kids that ran the spectrum. And, you know, some of my favorite kids were the kids like Theo, who didn't really want to be there. They just wanted to be out, you know, have fun. And I tried to keep it, you know, I was never one of those coaches that got real serious about it, you know. And so Theo's the kind of kid that was really close to my heart at the time. You know, he's sharp as a whip, but he's unusual. He's quirky, you know. And the reason Penelope signed him up for baseball is she wants him to try to make some new friends. He's kind of one of those kids that's a little eccentric, perhaps. There's some poignancy, I hope, with Theo. So the book is a silly comedy. It's meant to be sort of a forget-your-troubles read, a light, fun summer read. But I'm hoping there's some, you know, the mother-son stuff, I think, is true to heart. Penelope is not a conventional mother, but I think she's a good mother. The serious part would be the mother-son stuff. You know, he's getting bullied on the bus. And so that's one of the ongoing plot points is, will that get addressed or not?
Yeah, I remember the last time we spoke when Love's Winning Plays came out. You said you wanted to write a lighter novel and then a serious novel. A lighter novel and a serious novel.
Yeah, that was the plan. I'd done that. I'd gone serious, light. And so I was due for a serious. I'm telling you this, I was kind of laid up for about 7 months.
Oh, man.
Yeah, let's not go into it, but I'm fine now. But I mean, so I'm basically always writing the book I want to read right then. What I wanted to read, what I wanted to do was to laugh. And so when I'm writing these comedies, I'm trying to make myself laugh first. You know, my office is right there off the kitchen. It's really off the carport. So the kids come in, throw their stuff down. So I'm always got, I don't even close the door, but, you know, I'll hear my kids in there, dad's laughing at his own jokes again, you know, from the office. So that was the plan to switch, but really the muse just kept saying, do this, do this, do this, do this. And then once I wrote it, I thought, you know, I'd like to do a series like this. You know, P.G. Wodehouse has those Birdie and Jews books where, like, everyone you open, you know, is going to have the same sort of plot. It's super light. You're going to have 3 hours of fun reading it. And then you open up the next one, it's going to be the exact same thing. You know, the stakes are going to be low, things are going to turn out happily, and it's just going to be a goofy fun. So now, you know, what I do want to do for each book is something different. Swimming in the Sky was first person, present tense, coming of age. My second book was, I want to try a comedy, so I did a first-person comedy. I was scared of the third-person point of view. I just didn't think I could do it and keep it immediate enough. You know, I thought it would feel like, you know, I was observing the character instead of, you know, becoming the character. And so then I said, I want to try a third-person book. And not only that, I want to try a shifting viewpoint book and add some experimental stuff in there. So The Millionaire was my big, ambitious book. And then I thought, well, let's try a third-person comedy. So Love's Winning Plays is a third-person limited to one protagonist's point of view. And then I said, well, I've never written a whole book from a female perspective. You know, The Millionaires has got, when I'm shifting perspectives, you'll have some scenes from the female perspective, some of the female characters, and I enjoyed that. I had some women readers say that, you know, I didn't botch it too badly. So I thought, well, let's try a comedy from a female perspective. And then once I started, it's like, I've never done a series before. I wonder if I could do a series. And these books are fun to write. I can write them quickly. So I'd like to ride this train for a while if I could. I've kind of got this whole Faulknerian, what county was he from?
Yakupatop.
Yeah, exactly. Universe in my head. I lived half my life in like Knoxville, Nashville, Charlottesville, but I lived half my life in small towns like Tullahoma, Tennessee. I was there for 16 years. I lived in Waynesville, Virginia. So I've spent half my life in these small southern towns. I've met a lot of interesting, fun people that I'd like to, kind of see what I'd like to see them walking around some pages one of these days.
Now, is the Hillsborough, Virginia of your book the same one that's in real life?
I didn't know that. I thought I Googled it to see if there was. No. I was just thinking, I like Borough's a good name for a town. And I was like, oh, Hillsborough Pike. I was thinking of Hillsborough Pike here in Nashville, And so I did not know there was a Hillsborough, an actual Hillsborough. This is not Hillsborough, Virginia. It is a fictitious Hillsborough, Virginia. It's an alternative Hillsborough in Virginia.
Because the real one's way up there by Harper's Ferry.
I just discovered that. People of Hillsborough, I'm not talking about you. No, so my Hillsborough is no place really, it's got a, if I need a lake, it's got a lake. If I need a river, I got a river. Anything I've ever seen in any small town I've lived in, it's got it. And so it's sort of a combination of every small town I've ever lived in and known people in. So it's I'm thinking just like a, would you call this PG-13 or R-rated?
I would say it'd be a light R.
So I'm looking for...
It's right there on the edge.
Right. I'm thinking an R-rated Mayberry is what I'm going for. I think that's what it, it's a little bit risque, but the stakes are low. Nothing really bad is ever going to happen.
You were talking about writing the book that you wanted to read, and that's something that the people in this book do, is they actually read books. And it seems like you almost never see that in books nowadays, people actually engaging with literature. Well, or literature with scare quotes.
Well, Les William Plays, you recall.
He was in a book club.
He was in a book club. So, and that one I had some fun with book club and book club questions. And in this one, in the first scene, really the comic engine of this book is Missy, this woman she meets at baseball practice. If you imagine Lucy and Ethel, Penelope would be Ethel, and Missy, the friend she meets, another single mom, would be Lucy. And so in the first chapter, you see Penelope's at the practice. Most of the other parents there are married, and she sees this other woman who she'd never met before reading off by herself, away from the crowd, reading. And she notices her son looks like he might not be a jockish type. And she's like, well, that kid looks interesting. Maybe he'll be friends with my son, Theo. So she sort of approaches this woman. She's trying to sidle up for her. And the first thing she does is realize what she's reading. She realizes she's reading an erotic novel. So this woman, the first time she sees her, she's reading an erotic novel at a little kid baseball practice. And so somehow they become friends in that moment. And from there on out, she's kind of the comic engine of the novel.
How much of the plot of The Tycoon's Dare did you dream up and have?
Well, yeah, all of it. All the stuff about the erotic novels and stuff. It's like, I think there's the Stranger Within is one, and The Tycoon's Dare. I'm having fun with that 50 Shades of Grey stuff, where it's always like a rich guy with this sort of small town girl, and he's going to corrupt her, and it's always like they're flying to expensive places. And it's escapist fiction. So I'm having some fun at 50 Shades of Grey. Is that what it's called, 50 Shades of Grey?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Oh, you read it. You did.
No, I haven't actually read that one. Now, I did read... I didn't even read that one. There's a Nashville author, Ruta Sepeda. She wrote one called Between Shades of Grey, which was actually about a young woman escaping Nazi-occupied Lithuania in World War II.
And that's erotic novel?
It's not an erotic novel.
Didn't
but,
sound like
but,
it.
But the name of her book, Between Shades of Grey, got confused with 50 Shades of Grey, and she sold a lot of books to people who weren't exactly looking for a young adult novel based on escaping Nazis.
That would be quite a surprise when you open up the envelope and you're expecting...
I guess Sophie's Choice would be like the middle
mark
between those two books.
Right. So, I'm having a goof on those sorts of books.
Even though she's talking to a person reading it, and she has read it herself, she won't admit to her that she's read it.
Right. At first she lies and says, have you read this book? And so they're both kind of acting like they're... Like Missy, the wild woman, is acting like her friend gave this book, and she catches Penelope spying on her. She's like, have you read this crap? And then Penelope lies and says she hadn't, when she actually has. And then it turns out she comes clean and says, actually, I have read that. She thinks the woman's sort of standoffish and snobby. And the woman goes, did you like it? And it's like, Penelope said, yeah, do you? And it ends up, they both admit to loving the book. It's like a guilty pleasure, you know? So it's not like that's all Penelope reads. You know, she reads some serious stuff, too. But especially when you go through a tough time, you don't want to read something serious. You know, you want to escape its fiction. So erotica would fit that. Hopefully my novel would fit that. You know, I think in 2018, if you could find 3 hours to forget your troubles, that's something to shoot for.
What was the book James was reading that took him almost a year to get
Anna,
through?
Anna Karenina. He's an intellectual poser, you know, so he wants everybody to think he's smart. He'd read 3 pages of Anna Karenina and then fall asleep. During the time she read 42 books.
And Missy named her son Damien. And Penelope, although not an angel, is a churchgoer, and so she really wonders about that name.
Well, I think the main thing is she saw the movie The Omen. She's like in middle school, and it just absolutely freaked her out. So she can't believe anybody would name their son Damien. So that's kind of a recurring joke in there, too. She's supposed to be like the Kramer of the book, I guess. She's like just full on.
Almost id.
Id, exactly. She's the id. And her friends, Rachel and Sandy, are sort of the super ego. Like, you don't need to date for a while. You need to take up a hobby. You need to do this. You need to do that. And Missy's saying, let's just go have fun. She's got warring friends telling her different things.
Now, there's something else on Penelope's mind when she's at the baseball practice. Theo's being bullied on the bus.
Yes, you know, it happens sometimes in the school bus. Do you want me to mention what he's being called specifically?
No, I think we can skip over that.
He's being called names on the bus that aren't very flattering.
But are accurate.
Accurate, yes. One of them has been sort of earned by Theo. He's kind of done a few things that, to gain attention for himself.
He could use some Vino or some Gas X.
Yes, he could use some Gas X. That's a delicate way to put it. Well, there's a couple of serious problems going on, but that's one of the main ones that's on her mind. School's about to end. If they don't get this handled on the bus, it's going to continue the next year. She just recently found out about it, and it's going to continue over the summer. These kids live nearby, so she's trying to decide to tell the teacher. Her son's bigger. Don't tell the teacher. It's not that big a deal. Her ex-husband's saying, no, it's just dumb boy stuff. But, you know, she's bothered by it. And so she is going to try to get Theo to take the bull by the horn. So she ends up giving him wrestling lessons. You know, and so hopefully
professional wrestling lessons.
Professional wrestling lessons, correct. She fancies herself quite a good wrestler.
Give us a little Macho Man.
Tower of Power, too sweet to be sour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, she's a fan of Randy Macho Man Savage. So that comes into play as well. So that's the bullying situation. So I've got some real issues here that a single mom would deal with. And so dealing with that sort of stuff is not fun. I have some fun with it within the book, I hope, as well.
In addition to being a single mother, she's also a daughter. And she and Theo are living with her mother and her stepfather, George, in this, and it's not an ideal situation.
No, it's not. You know, so she doesn't have her own computer, so she has to use her stepfather's computer. And he's a great guy, but while she's down there, she occasionally he's got a really old, bad computer. She keeps getting these pop-ups of things she does not want to see pop-up advertisements for. She hasn't had a date since her divorce, and her mom and stepfather seem to have really rejuvenated their love life. And her bedroom is right below theirs. And so, yeah, it's a little awkward for Penelope. A few times she hears things and sees things she wished she hadn't from her elderly mother.
Well, and it was really nice that George has been her stepfather since she was 12, and he's a really good guy. There's no malice in him at all.
No. He's good old George, sweet George. And, you know, you never see him in the book. He's mentioned, he's smoking a pipe in the back. But he has been a really good force in her life. She trusts him, and he loves her, and she loves him. So, my stepfather is not in any way based on – George is not in any way based on my stepfather, who is from the Bronx, is out in Denver now. But, you know, he's been a really nice guy to me, too. So, I think sometimes step-parents get a bad rap. I've had some good ones, you know, and some ones that played important parts of my life, you know, for 25, 26, 27 years.
Now, I have to say, at one point, I thought you were writing my life because I was terrible at Little League. I'm a pompous middle-aged man. My name is Steve. There's a guy named Super Steve in the book.
My dad's
name is George, and I've got a sister named Missy.
Wow. I think I must be channeling you somehow. I wouldn't call you pretentious.
Oh, well, you only see me once every few years.
Well,
I do get through more than one book a year, though.
Okay. That's funny. All those elements were going for you. Yeah.
Yeah, I was really connecting with a lot of different characters in there.
Like in a good way or like uncomfortable?
Well, I like my family. Yeah, I'm lucky in that regard.
All right, cool.
Penelope's mom is a bit presumptuous, and she gets her Penelope a subscription to the dating app Devote.
She gets her a dating app. It's for modern Christians on the go. And she also gets her one of those online deals. It's like Match.com type deal. I call it Love Sync in my books. Her mom is very worried about her being single, much more so than Penelope is. So she buys her these two dating things to try to get her back in the game. And, you know, I think I got the idea from that a long time ago. My aunt Betty, who the book is dedicated to, she passed away about a year ago, was the first person I knew who did online dating. Her luck was a mixed bag, I think, like most people's. She met some nice guys, but she had some funny dates. And she would tell these great stories, and she had a real appreciation, an eye for the absurdities in life. So it's kind of her spirit that informs this book, you know, that just looking at things a little cockeyed, you know. But I just realized how tough it would be. I mean, it was tough for me being single at 30. So, you know, being single is tough, you know, if you want to date. If you prefer not to be single, it's tough. And I think it's even tougher in a small town. You know, there's not that many people you haven't met before. You know, so it's just tough. So I'm working with that. I hope there's some poignancy to it, too. You know, I'm sympathetic, I think, to that, to folks that are having to start dating again in their 40s or 50s or after, and especially trying to be a mom to a young kid and also date. Those are two sort of challenging roles that are sometimes hard to get to sync up. So I'm looking at that, I hope, in a light but sensitive and sympathetic way.
A way that the world of men and women are different, especially when it comes to online dating, is when she gets a picture from a younger man who's very chiseled and he's got his shirt taken off, she doesn't immediately think that someone's trying to steal her credit card numbers or anything like that.
So we see a date where she ends up, Missy talks her into going to this party with the young guy that probably not really interested in him. He's a little too young, a little too immature, you know.
He's got a lot of bro in him.
He's a bit of a bro guy, wears his cap backwards, you know, and he's a high-fiving, fist-bumping dude, like 40 times an hour. And so that's one of my favorite scenes. A little bit risque, but what was your question? Where am I going with this?
Well, that it's a completely different experience for men and women online and these dating things.
Yeah, man. I mean, a lot of the stuff in the book is stuff that's happened to people we know, and like, you know, guys sending pictures that they don't want to see. And I was like, and so she's like, that happens to her, and she's like, going, who in the world would think this would be in any way enticing? You know, here comes the helicopter right on time. Oh, over here. I never did it, you know. I had to go meet my wife the old-fashioned way in a bar. you know, I have students that write about this stuff. You know, at one point, someone said, I was like, this doesn't really happen that much. I was like, and like every girl, and all my female students raised a hand that someone has sent them this very inappropriate picture. And it's just like, what in the world is going on out there with guys that think this is cool? Because it's not cool.
That party she went to with all these young single Christians who are very adamant about their Christianity, listen to contemporary Christian rock, just seemed like we could have been in Dante's Inferno at that point.
Well, but, you know, but Penelope, that's the thing about Penelope is, Missy's complaining about that they're not serving any alcohol, they're playing cornhole, but, you know, Penelope's got just someone who goes with the flow. She likes playing cornhole. She doesn't love the music. It's a younger crowd. She goes to church, but she's not quite as serious about it as these folks are. But people are nice to her there, and so she's not really complaining about the party. So Missy's the one complaining. Penelope's having a good time, you know. So she's just somebody that can go with the flow, a live and let live person. And that's one of the things I really like about her and respect about her is wherever she is, she's going to be Penelope Lemon. You know, she can be with her pompous husband who's very proud to be a UNC graduate and obviously very smart and not feel intimidated. She could be hanging out with people, you know, that are pretty country, and you know, and she's going to be the same person. She doesn't treat you differently based on your intelligence or your money or whether you're in the country club or not the country club. She treats you just how you are. If you're nice, she treats you nice. If you're not, she still tries to treat you nice for as long as she can, and then she realizes, well, maybe this person's in someone I don't need to be around.
Her career prospects aren't great because she dropped out of college to marry her first husband.
My first job teaching was at Motlow State Community College. So I was there for 5 years, and that was in Tullahoma. I had so many smart women coming back to college in their late 20s, 30s, or 40s who'd maybe married their high school boyfriend, didn't work out, and they're just sharp as a tack. You know, I go into the bank somewhere in Tullahoma or Waynesboro, and the teller there is just sharp as a tack. Like, she should be the bank president, but she doesn't have the degree. When I was sick in the hospital, you know, I had these nurses that, like, were doing 14 different things at once, and they were so smart and so sharp and fun and cool, and I couldn't have done that job. So a lot of these jobs that people have, they're respectable jobs, they're honest jobs, but they may not be the most glamorous, the most high-paying job. There's a lot of sharp people who just didn't have the right parents to send them to college, or couldn't afford it, or made some mistake along the way, but there's millions of people out there like that, and I shouldn't see them represented in fiction that much. So I'm trying to get at that a little bit. Yeah, the job prospects, she did 2 years of college. She's doing well, but she fell in love with this hot guy, this hot, fun guy, and she made that mistake. And just then she got married to James, so she's just never gone back to finish. She could have finished. And so she's in a small town without a college degree, and there's not a heck of a lot of job prospects. So she ends up, the first job she can get is, you know, waiting tables, which, you know, I've done that, and I've done a lot of bartending too. So I was able to call on my service industry history for some of that scene.
And she's waiting tables at a themed steakhouse. What's the name and the theme on the steakhouse?
The name is Coonskin, Where Fun Meets Frontier. Is that what it's called? Something like Where Fun Meets Frontier. So it's like a faux roadhouse places in a strip mall where they, you know, have stuffed raccoons all over the place, and there's they throw peanut shells on the floor.
But some people like throwing them at her.
Yeah, she gets this one family, and the kitchen botches their order, and they start taking it out on poor Penelope, who's a good server. You know, she's probably the best server they have. If you've ever bartended or waited tables or done anything in the service industry, you're going to come across people that are just jerks. And so she comes across this jerky family who start, when she turns her back to go back to the kitchen, the order's been messed up, no fault of her own, they are popping her with peanut. And that eventually must cease. Penelope only could take so much. As we mentioned earlier, she was a fan of Randy Macho Man Savage. So some of her wrestling background may come into play in this scene. They throw one too many peanuts.
But as you mentioned, her first ex-husband, she just refers to as HHR.
Huge redneck.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the redneck is such a loaded word. I didn't want to keep using it. So HHR is a little more innocuous. And this guy's innocuous. He's not, you know, when I think redneck, I think some of this mean and violent and hateful and spiteful. He's none of that stuff. He's really just a
good old boy.
A good old goofball. You know, he's a guy who's got a lot more in business. He just wants to smoke weed, mow lawns, and hang out with his buddies. Go fishing, that sort of stuff. But he's a good guy. He's a sweet guy. Doesn't have a mean bone. She still likes him, you know. He's good looking. He was her high school love, you know. He's one of my favorite characters. I had a lot of fun writing him. You know, like I say, I think I'm a little bit like Penelope. This may sound like I'm bragging, but I've known a bunch of people from a different walks of life. I've sat with HHR, a guy like the HHR before, hung out at his place before. So, I hope that comes across, that he is a nice guy, even though he's just, you know, a bit eccentric in the good old boy fashion.
I'll have to say, the line about Boston Legal made me laugh out loud.
Thank you. We can't talk about that too much because
I didn't want to give that away, but I just wanted to say that line just made me laugh out loud.
Thank you. When she calls him, that's one of my favorite scenes I've ever written. Just, you know, she's confronting him about something. He's in the middle of bonging up, and they have a pretty funny conversation, I think.
When you're writing a book with a lot of humor in it, it seems like pacing would be even more important than it is with just a regular novel.
Yeah, yeah. Shakespeare, brevity is the essence of wit. Humor's got to go fast. This was my shortest novel I ever wrote. Michael Griffin at LSU was my editor. Fantastic line editor. And he found, you know, I can't remember, 7,000-8,000 words to cut. And so it wasn't like scenes, just a sentence here. So it's my tightest book that I've written. And a lot of that credit goes to my editor. You know, he really made me work hard for every word. You know, you want to keep it moving. If you're at a party or somebody tells a funny story, that at some point you got to wrap it up. You don't want to hear somebody be long-winded like I'm being right now with this answer.
Now, there's another man who's contacted her via the dating services. He's an older man. This is on the online service, not the Christian dating app. And he goes by the sobriquet Fitzwilliam. And I will admit, I could not read his emails. They were just so cringy. I said, okay, moving on.
Yeah, he's sort of he's either English or an Anglophile. He makes James look modest and unpretentious by comparison. So you never see him in the book. So her prospects in Hillsboro are for dating. Till you see her, like, a much too young bro or an older, super pretentious, I guess he's a gentleman, who thinks he lives in England, even though he's in Virginia.
An aspirational gentleman.
an aspirational gentleman. But Fitzwilliam, I've already written the sequel, he plays a big part in the sequel, and we go and see her date with him. And it's a good scene.
Boy, I hope his language gets toned down in person.
No, well there's some...
I hope there's not a whole lot of maladies in it.
No, well, there's a few. It's funny, Stephen. You'll have to suffer through it.
Have you already finished the first draft on that one, or...?
I have. I haven't really started sending it out yet. Still waiting to see how this one does. This one's got to do a certain amount of business before someone's going to do the sequel. So I think, I'm kind of wait-and-see mode right now. I'm hoping it catches a little fire. Again, the sequel's done. It's funny. In a perfect world, this is like the pilot episode of a comedy, and I laid the groundwork for the characters. And so the next book, some people will play more major roles. You'll see more of Missy, more of Dimwit, more of Fitzwilliam. You won't see the mom as much.
Well, thank goodness for that.
We see a little bit more of her than anyone should. So in a perfect world, I'm going to just keep... I'm going to have a recurring cast of characters. Some two or three new ones will be introduced each time. So, like I say, I've got this whole universe in my head that I'd love to get down sometime.
Do you have a name for that one yet?
Operation Dimwit.
Oh, no. I don't know if I can handle any more of Dimwit.
Dimwit gets his this time.
Well, Inman, I want to say thanks so much for taking some time out of hanging out with your family to talk with me for a little bit.
Stephen, I appreciate you coming up to the Music City to hang out. It's always great to talk to you, and thanks for having me on.
All righty.
Inman Majors is the author of Penelope Lemon, Game On, which is available from Yellow Shoe Fiction, a series from LSU Press. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.